Welcome to City Talks, a monthly podcast looking at the big issues facing UK cities and the latest thinking on urban policy. I'm your host, Andrew Carter, from the think tank Centre for Cities. I hope you enjoy the episode. Welcome to this edition of City Talks. Today, my guest is David Blanchflower. David is a well-known economist, former member of the Bank of England's Monetary Policy Committee, and his time coincided with the Great Recession. He's Professor of Economics at Dartmouth College, and he's the author of a new and his latest book called Not Working, Where Have All the Good Jobs Gone? And it's the subject of today's podcast. Danny, welcome to City Talks.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start by, actually the title of this of the book itself I think is interesting, because you talk about the not working element, but you also say something about good jobs, which is a very live topic.
Right.
It's not just jobs, it's good jobs, as people often say. And for those that haven't read the book yet, you start with a brilliant quote from Yossa Hughes.
Yeah.
Which was from a program in the 90s around Boys from the Black Stuff and Give Us a Job.
Gives a Job.
It's one of my favourite
People in America
programs.
Have no idea.
No, I'm sure they don't.
What I'm talking about. But I do start off actually with another quote directly underneath it, researching this book. And I was looking at the Gallup website, and I start off with this quote. Gallup, the polling agency around the world, Gallup says, they've been known for all their public opinion polls. And what they say on their website, here is one of Gallup's most important discoveries since its founding in 1935. What the whole world wants is a good job.
Yeah.
So in a sense, that's relevant to Britain, because what we've seen in Britain is that employment has risen. Bad employment, if you like, has risen, but wages haven't. So real wages today are 6% below what they were in 2008. So on the one hand, you have this contrast of rising employment. America's a bit different. We can get to America.
Yeah.
So then the question is it just about getting jobs? And is that enough? And the answer clearly is that's not enough. One of the big things that I talk about in the book is really important, is that people get jobs often with not enough hours. And sometimes, and I like to think of this as a sort of job pyramid, in a recession, people who've got degrees enter lower down that pyramid than they would in the past. So they enter at places where, you know, someone who hasn't got a degree enters. Essentially, the big deal right now is we haven't really seen that changing much. Even though the economy has been improving and the labour market has been improving, we haven't suddenly seen people climbing up that job pyramid as they would in the past. And I think a great deal of Brexit and Trump and Le Pen is that people have not been able to get good jobs, particularly in relation to the kind of jobs that their fathers and their grandfathers have. So that's the big deal, and oftentimes it's for the less educated that the problem is.
Yeah, and what is it your sense that, you know, jobs that were in existence before or around the Great Recession have gone away, or is it that those jobs are still there, but actually the quality of those jobs or the wages on offer have declined kind of nominally and obviously relatively?
Bits of both.
Yeah.
People in jobs who've been there for long tenure have actually done relatively well. But think about in the public sector.
Yeah.
One of the stories we should remember is that public sector pay has been held down hugely for a long time. So the real earnings of people in the public sector have been held down, and the attractiveness of public sector jobs to others is less than it was. So there's some of that, but particularly the new jobs that have been coming haven't been as good. So a particular group that we care about are the young, and I say they suffer a double whammy, if you like. They can get a job, but if they do get a job, it's a bad, crummy one with not enough pay and not enough hours.
Yeah.
I think we just have to think, if you were to argue, and the basis of the book is policymakers, the central banks around the world say, well, the economy's at full employment. And I say, well, if we're at full employment, why is everybody hurting? That doesn't make any sense to me. I think of full employment, and it's the great, and we'll talk a bit about Beveridge, but Beveridge defined full employment to be workers are standing by, waiting as job offers flood in, and they can choose between them, and the quality of those jobs rises, and the pay from those jobs rises. I also say in the book a little bit, I don't know where full employment is, but it's like pornography. I can't define it, but I know it when I see it.
Yeah, and you're critical in the book around, you know, some of your economist colleagues that would argue that we are at sort of full employment, or, you know, we're close to the full employment rate. Your argument is we aren't, and it, you know, actually it's probably lower than a lot of our models suggest.
Right. So the reason for that is that people have wrongly looked at stuff that occurred before 2008.
Right.
I first learned labour economics in London, actually. I went to Queen Mary, and I used to go every week to a seminar at the London School of Economics. It was a labour economics seminar. It was called the unemployment seminar. And all we would focus on was unemployment, because that's all you needed to focus on. Yep. Every other thing correlated to it. The problem today is that the unemployment rate is no good as an indicator of what's going on. So think about when unemployment was low, wages would be high, and employment would be high. Well, that's all broken down. And what we have right now is relatively low unemployment rates in the threes, but I said a minute ago, real wages are 6% below what they were in 2008. And we've seen no sign of them picking up. Actually, in the last 3 months, real wages have ticked down again.
Yeah.
So there's that. That's a really big deal. But the measure that I care about a lot is a measure we call underemployment. And we ask people, are you content with how many hours that you have? And the answer is lots of them say no, and particularly during the Great the years after the Great Recession, there were lots and lots of hours, and there still are. People would like more hours than is under offer. And again, think of the logic. If you were at full employment, a firm could get more labour by saying, would you like to work 6 hours more a week? And you say, yep. Well, if you were at full employment, people wouldn't be saying that in the numbers that they are. And the other thing we know is that the declining well-being we've seen, particularly amongst the underemployed, their well-being has ticked down a lot since 2008. So this is a group really to care about. It matters for the economics, but it turns out the central bankers haven't kind of noticed that the world changed in 2008. Workers and normal people were scared senseless by the big declines that they saw, the houses that they lived in, the prices fell, their savings, their pension funds, in many cases went away, and they've been scared. And that's basically what I see in the data. But the contrast between me, who says, no, we're not at full employment, and lots of policymakers who said they were, and now we're in a situation where it's clear they were wrong.
what's been the reticence, the reluctance of your colleagues in the profession to grapple with which I have deep sympathy for, this is self-evident in the sense if you look at the data, if one was wrong, you would see wage growth at much higher rates than it currently. So just give me a sense of, we were talking a little bit before we came on air.
Such a mean question. The foolish answer I'd give you is you'd have to ask them, but I guess you want more than that. I'm going to give you more than that. I mean, what we have to remember, let's start from 2008. I mean, I was on this committee, and in 2007, October, I started to vote for rate cuts because it seemed to me that the most horrendous crisis was coming. And I voted on my own for 12 months. Nobody even kind of thought this was happening. And then the giant recession came. If you look at the Fed, so this is the central bank in America, the US economy went into recession, we know now, in December 2007. On the day that Lehman Brothers failed in the middle of 2008, so that's what, 9 months after the US had gone into recession, the central bank still had no idea that the US economy was in recession. So that's the first thing. I guess I call it they missed the big one. And economics hasn't really improved much since then. Essentially what they thought was that, okay, we've been over the Great Recession, everything's finished, in 2009-10, all is well, and we're back to normal again. And that's not true. And there's a great quote that I always use in all the talks, which is that Keynes was asked in 1931, after the Great Crash, what's coming? And he said the great worry is that what's going to come are what he called the long dragging conditions of semi-slump. So I think what's happened is the policymakers have kind of looked at the period 1945 to 2008, which has nothing to do with where we are, and ignored what happened in the 30s. And why is that? Well, what's the similarity between now and the 30s? Well, the answer, the 30s was a giant financial crisis, a giant crash. And so was 2007-08, and we've not had one in between.
Yeah.
So the problem is that essentially the policymakers thought all is well, all will bounce back to the way that it was before, and we can impose austerity and all will be fine. Well, all of that turned out to be completely nonsense. So let's put it in context. In the UK, we now have seen the third slowest recovery ever in 600 years. This is the slowest of 300. The one that was slower was the South Sea Bubble 300 years ago. And the one before that was the Black Death 600 years ago. So put it in, that's why people are hurting. And the ideas that were used in the past have not been adapted. And unfortunately, economics has not adapted. And now we're in a situation where policymakers have made errors. And now it looks like around the world that we're headed for another recession brought about by failures of policymakers. Mm. And just last thing to put it in context, in the US in June 2019, now the recovery is the longest recovery ever. And recoveries eventually run out. So yeah. I think we're at the point now where essentially the recoveries run out because of failures of policymakers again.
Yeah, quite. And in the book, when you're setting out the case for how you came to what the conclusions that you came to, your particular focus on underemployment as much as unemployment, which is the much more classical area to focus on. You use the phrase the economics of walking about,
right?
Which is a layman's term, but actually it's like using
talk to people,
but also using additional data sets and insights that we can glean to supplement and complement what we would use more classically in terms of whatever. Just say a little bit more about economics of walking about.
So this, in a sense, this is good for people listening, because I take the sense that people know much more than the economists do. So if you look back to 2008, what I mean by the economics of walking about is you talk to people, you talk to businesses, you talk to people, you listen to what they have to say. And I have two stories that really got me. So in early 2008, I'm trying to think what's going on, and the data aren't really kind of matching it. My colleagues don't think there's anything going on. I'm in a cab going down Oxford Street, and I said something, and the cab driver, for some reason, said, "I know who you are." Oh, okay. I don't know it's that famous. But anyway, he said to me, "I'm glad that you got in the cab. I've got something to tell you." He said, "I've been driving up and down Oxford Street for like 30 years. And he said, "I've spotted something I've never seen before." And I went, "What the heck's that?" Yeah. And he said, "Look around you." And he said, "The shoppers aren't carrying shopping bags." "I've never seen it before," he said. "It was the January sales. I've never seen it before," he said. So I said that on a radio show. And 2 days later, a gentleman called me up and said, "I have a story for you." He said, "The story is that I run a company that services tires. It's a tire service company. And what we do is we put tachometers on the business's trucks, particularly delivery trucks." And he said, "We, for the first time in years and years and years, have noticed that the delivery trucks have less miles than they've ever had in the past." Right. Completely consistent. So this is about talk to firms, talk to businesses. So here's another story right now. So if you look in the data today, it turns out that the unemployment rate has fallen from 6% to below 3%. And there's a great series that I like, which is, again, just talk to people. So this series says to people, this is a question every month, and they say to people, "What do you think is going to happen to unemployment?" Well, it turned out in 2007, that series picked up. My colleagues weren't looking at it. I was looking at it. And basically, if you talk to people, they knew a crisis was coming.
Yeah.
What's interesting, since 2015, that series has risen steadily. So as the unemployment rate in Britain has fallen from 6 to below 4, people think the unemployment rate's about to rise. Presumably they feel it.
Yeah.
They feel what happens in their pay packet. They feel what's going on around them. You talk to the taxi driver, and the taxi driver this morning told me something interesting. He told me that in the past it used to be that taxis were a really good barometer of what's happened to the economy. And he said, "It's no good anymore because of that car that's in front of me." And he said, "It's a Uber."
Uber.
He said, "I don't think we're quite as good a barometer as we were in the..." But that's the economics of walking about.
Yeah.
You talk to people, you talk to firms, you ask them what's going on. And it turns out that's, in the last 15 years, that's much better than listening to any of these economists, the hundreds of economists that work in these forecasting groups. Once I said, we'd have been better off if they all delivered pizza instead. And somebody said to me, that would be no good because they'd never show up on time or find the right address. So but the point of the book is to actually show you the data, to show you that when you talk to these people, and you do the economics of walking about, it gives you much more sense than economists playing with these silly models. And they have been wrong, so wrong, so wrong.
Yeah.
We then have to try and think about the ways to be right. And the sense that I have is that people are hurting and they don't think everything's going to be so great. And they listen to stuff like the election of potentially a British prime minister, which is craziness Mark 32. And again, the cab driver said to me this morning, Well, obviously, what the problem with this is uncertainty. And I said, you just passed economics 101. Yeah. You got it. You got it. And why do you think investment's falling? Why do you think firms are unhappy? Why do you think the CBI says this is crazy? It's because of huge amounts of uncertainty. So I just think, talk to people. They know what's going on. Yeah, yeah. And the economists probably don't.
No. No, well, I think it's a, yeah, it's a good... You know, it's a good reminder that, yes, you know, our models and are all well and good and you know, undoubtedly useful, but you need to complement them.
The long dragging conditions of semi-slump, that's the state we're in.
Yes.
And the banks and everybody else have kind of missed it. But yeah. Keynes said it in 1931.
Yeah.
And the reality is that the Great Depression didn't have the Great Recession. But we are in the Great Recession. We already had the Great Depression. We should have learned from
it. Yeah. So just for the, because the book is, you know, you're looking at these issues as they apply and as they play out. You know, you talk a lot about the US and obviously the UK and obviously European countries. But just for the, obviously we have high rates of employment in the UK relative to what they, you know, what they have historically been.
Right.
The US is a slightly different story, isn't it? Which is
So we have a puzzle, which in the UK employment is basically the employment rates. That's just the proportion of people. So imagine I take 40-year-olds and I call it the employment rates. Just what proportion of 40-year-olds are employed? The answer in the UK, that's picked back up again. In the US, that hasn't.
No.
It's about 2.5 percentage points below where it was. But the difference is that real wages in the US are higher.
Right.
So we've had a little bit of a trade-off. People have got higher wages for lower employment. But the reason I like to cut to the chase is that there's two phenomena, a particular phenomenon really now, which is that wages aren't growing as quickly as you would have thought in both the UK and the US. And the one phenomenon that's common to both is my underemployment phenomenon. Mm. In both of those countries, the underemployment rate gives you the story, and particularly the story is that it's not back to the levels that it was prior to the recession. So if you were in full employment, you'd be back to where you were.
Yeah.
And you need to, what labour economists like me call the amount of slack in the economy. What I mean by that is how much extra work could be done if the economy was cranking.
Yeah.
So if you say, I've got 20 hours a week and I'd like 30, well, there's a potential we could get 10 more hours. And a lot of the times it's asked, would you like more hours at the same wages you're being paid? It doesn't say, you know, if we gave you £100 extra an hour. It's literally, this is viable hours. But there's a big deal about this, which we'll come to, which in a sense is what's happened. Well, I suppose I should do it now. What prior to 2008, in a sense, what impacted wages was the amount of the unemployed out there, people you didn't know. But what's happened now, it appears, is that firms have got two groups of people within the firm. They've got people who are not underemployed and people who are within the same firm who are underemployed. And both groups know each other. But the underemployed are keeping the wages down of people in the same organization.
Right.
So you might think we've gone from an external margin to an internal margin.
Yeah.
People know they underemployed in their firms. And that's, in a sense, what's containing wage pressure.
So there's a bit of discipline that's been introduced into the labor market because
Absolutely.
Of the experiences that people have gone through.
Absolutely.
They're fearful of loss of job, so they take lower wages or they take fewer hours because that's a better alternative than... no job or no hours at all.
I couldn't have said it better. You've got it absolutely exactly right.
Yeah.
And security and keeping the job is better than the insecurity that comes from not having it, even though you have less hours than you would like. I mean, obviously people would like higher wage rates, but a lot of the times they're saying in the data that we have around the world, we'd like more hours at the going wage. So how could that be full employment?
Yeah.
I mean, a firm could increase how much work is done, not by hiring other people, but by simply saying, okay, the people are working 3 days a week, would you like to work another day a week? And the person says, yeah. So that I think is the disconnect between policymakers, central bankers saying we're at full employment and talking to the people, and that's present in the data. And it turns out that's a lot about hurting.
Mm.
Yeah, I have a job, I'm struggling, my wages are less than they were, and I don't see much hope coming.
No.
And that's, in a sense, that hopelessness explains Trump, it explains Brexit, it explains Le Pen, it explains many things around the world. And I'm sure we're going to talk about Well, what do you do about
yeah.
it? And what's happened, of course, is that people have voted for Brexit and Trump, but nothing's improved.
Yeah.
Supports remain pretty solid. Down the road, we'll have to see. But this is a really interesting phenomenon.
Yeah.
And if you're thinking about an election for a Tory party leader, the question you should ask them is, what are you going to do about it? What are you going to do about all the people who voted for Brexit who are hurting?
Yeah.
I don't see any of them actually having anything to offer these folks.
No.
What are they going to say to the person in Wakefield
yeah.
or in Blackpool? I mean, or in Swindon, where the car plant's going to close, or in Bridgend
yeah.
or in Sunderland, or in Scunthorpe. At some point, the people are going to say, hang on, you guys, you promised me stuff. And we're going to have to think about that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, let's turn to that, because, you know, there are hints throughout the book about, you know, A, by thinking about these issues in a different way, the policy focus becomes... you know, maybe also changes as well. But towards the end of the book, you have this kind of the section, you know, what to do.
Right.
You list out a bunch of issues or areas that we ought to really be to be thinking about. In my list, there was a kind of at least seven, but maybe they'll be probably in
sure.
your mind. And I think it'd just be useful. I don't know. It'd be useful just to get your, you know, A, what you think about those different aspects. And in you know things that you haven't put in the book that you would probably
sure.
you know you would want. So the first one is, which you've already alluded to, but nevertheless, is you say, you know, the first thing we need to do at the national scale is actually target full employment. Right? We need to be
yeah.
more deliberate and focused on issues in relation to full employment. So just say a little
no,
bit
no,
more on that.
Absolutely. I mean, I use the phrase put the pedal to
yeah.
the metal.
Yeah.
Let's get cranking. Let's move to a position where suddenly there are jobs for people who have been left behind. If we can push the economy to a much much bigger level of activity, that's a really good thing to do. And I see there's lots of capacity to do that. And in a sense, it's a criticism again of policymakers who think we can't do that because inflation's going to rise. And I have probably been on, I mean, hundreds of radio and TV programs where someone says to me, it's about inflation's about to take off, it's going to take off. And I said, but this is the 33rd month in a row that you've said that,
yes.
and it hasn't. So the answer is that it's really good for workers to be able to see the economy cranking. And there doesn't appear to be any inflation going on right now. Larry Summers has a famous phrase, let's just keep pumping the economy up until we see the whites of the eyes of inflation.
Yeah.
What's really interesting is that policymakers say, I'm really worried, I've got to slow the economy down because of the possibility of inflation. And then at the same time says, we don't know how to create any.
No.
So there's the big...
So that would be, you know, in your mind, that's maintaining the low interest rates that we've got in the
Absolutely.
UK. It's probably lowering them in the US rather than
Well, also
them.
Fiscal stimuli.
But also fiscal stimulus.
Fiscal
yeah?
stimuli yeah. targeted perhaps on the places where people are hurting
yeah.
seems like a really good idea. I think, in a sense, for you folks, a great way to think is this. The people who do worst in the slump are the people who do best in the boom. So you might think, in America particularly, the black young have incredibly high unemployment rates in the boom. But if you want to see unemployment rates that improve really, really, really fast, it's those.
Yeah.
So in a boom, I mean, in a boom, a rising tide lifts all boats. But what it's actually going to do is it's going to be able to help the ones who've been hurt the most.
Right.
And so that's a really big deal. And in some sense, what we've seen, when you talk about what interest rates do, if you care about cities and you care about regions and you care about places, the problem is that what governments have done is they've abrogated economic policy to the central bank. And there's only one interest rate.
Yes.
So the interest rate is probably too low in London and it's too high in Newcastle.
Yeah.
So what you've ended up doing essentially is you've removed regional policy and the central bank can't really do anything much
no.
about inequality either.
No.
So in a sense, that's a really big deal. And the fix, in a sense, is let's get these economies cranking and it will help people at the low end. Yes, raising the living wage and so on. But essentially, think of workers who suddenly start to get offers. They start to get job offers. People are out of the labour force in Wakefield. There's suddenly people will start to come there and hire them and offer them relatively decent jobs, and firms will see an attraction to go there.
Yeah.
So it's pretty hard to argue that you shouldn't go there. I mean, at some point, the economy overheats. But again, whites are the eyes. and talk to people and you say to firms, are you unable to find workers? Are you going to have to raise the prices? We've never seen that in however long.
No.
I mean, we've certainly not seen it, I think, in the last 20 years.
Yeah.
So, you know, other than, say, with an oil price just before 2008. So that's the really big deal. Let's get the economy going. Okay. Mostly because these central bankers have no clue what's called the Nehru, the level of full employment is. All we know is they got it too high and they tightened up and they raised rates and they stopped doing things too soon.
Yes.
Just like in 2010. They put on austerity, which was a disaster.
At a point, when the economy was slowly recovering, which people seem to forget.
Well, they were coming. No, actually, it wasn't really slowly.
We were coming out of the recession normal fashion, right?
Exactly. Well, the only word I would quibble there was fairly.
Right.
I mean, by 2009 Q2, stimulus had cranked. Central Bank was doing QE, cut rates to 0.5, and Gordon Brown was putting in stimulus as people were around the world. And by the middle part of 2010, the economy was growing nicely.
Yeah.
And then Osborne comes in, I call him Slasher, comes in and slashes everything and destroys the growth that we've seen in every recovery in the last 50 years and basically created by construction. There were no recovery till the worst recovery in 300 years by a matter of choice.
Yeah.
And destroyed the growth that was coming prior to 2010.
Yeah.
And that hurt especially.
Yeah.
Well, let's think of it hurt especially when the central bank does QE that I voted for. Particularly, that's going to help asset holders, people who own assets, who have pension funds, own stocks and shares, and people who own houses. So, in the cities and around Britain right now, who there's inequality? Who's hurting? Well, people who don't own houses and don't own assets.
That's inequality. We have a piece of research out very soon, which precisely shows this. Point. If you look at housing equity growth over the last 5 years, in London, the average for the average homeowner, it's over 100,000.
Right.
For the average homeowner in Sunderland, it's 5,000.
Right.
And that's simply, you know.
And again, I'm going to talk about my cabbie, who I just talked to this morning. He was telling me about house prices in London and the bank of mum and dad. And he said he bought a house in 1979 in London for 14,000. I had great conversations with Kevin. Yeah. He said he bought it for 14,000. It's worth about 350 today. But what can he do? His kids can't do anything. He's now had to go to the bank of mum and dad because, you know, there's no way that people can do that. So what's happened is the young have been hurt. And what's interesting is the young voted to remain and the old voted to leave. And the old voted to impose austerity on the young, and the old voted to raise tuition fees on the young, and then said you can't go and live and work in the rest of Europe.
Yeah.
And the young, I suspect, are not happy.
No,
I mean I've seen words like rage. I mean, you might think what we've seen for the first time in our lives is rage.
Yeah.
From various places.
No, well, quite. So, one is target full employment. I think about that much more consistently, coherently. Second is. You know, you're advocating for increasing of infrastructure spending, a kind of new deal, as it were.
Well,
I mean, in Britain, we've got, you know, conversations about should we, you know, are we going to build HS2? How far is it going to go? You know, there's a kind of conversation about that more, you know, the need to invest significantly in infrastructure in relation to transport, but also digital. You know, those are the kind of things you would want all of that to happen.
Yeah. Yes. I mean, you might even think. You set up, I don't know, in America it's called the National Science Foundation.
Yeah.
But it's think about, you set up a foundation which says, we want to research into high science. We don't know what to do, but we'll give you $1 billion or £1 billion. We'll give you lots of, let's think about new stuff. I mean, in a sense, what we have to learn from is go back to 2010. The Tory coalition cut public investment hugely, and that caused the economy to slow. What we've learned, in a sense, from... Trump, and even from the GOP, who used to think it was important to balance budgets, but now don't. And the debt rises by $2 trillion, and nothing actually happened. I mean, the reality is actually that you can borrow money so cheaply that it's hard to think that any investment that you do, sensible investment of the kind you describe, you build a bridge, you do roads, you do digital things, you do broadband, you do. All, you know, you could imagine, and you give money to, I mean, I don't know, maybe we give $5 billion to each of the huge technology companies and say, you know, invent stuff. So, and obviously, if you can borrow money at 1% and you invest it, I mean, if you invested it in roads, the productivity in the UK would rise if you could lower commuting times.
Yes.
So just think, literally, we're going to go out there. So firms can deliver things. The firm is sending people from place A to place B. If they can go there in half the time, like in London, if you had some mechanism solving the fact that it's raining and the cabs can't, I mean, just you get the point.
Yeah, yeah.
And then people get mixed up that a debt doesn't, it's different if you have a debt and you have a wild party. I mean, imagine we borrow money and we have a wild party which goes on for 4 days. We have nothing to show for it.
No.
Or alternatively,
A headache.
Right, that's exactly what we have. But we do what you've said. So this idea of doing infrastructure spend. And then the second thing, which is really important, is that the people who've lost out the most in America and Britain and all over the place are less educated, particularly prime age, mostly men, but not just.
Yeah.
And what's happened? Well, they've lost heavy manufacturing jobs, steel, coal, all of that. But the big deal is that there was other sets of jobs which were in construction. Construction unemployment rates around the globe are high. And construction jobs generally, for the less educated, are pretty darn good jobs.
Yeah.
So you do this infrastructure thing. You could do lots of the infrastructure in the places that were hurting. You could go to Yorkshire. You could build things there. You could build. The government wants an office for something. Office to do the infrastructure.
Yeah.
Well, you could put it in Yorkshire.
Yeah.
You could put it in the places where people. You could do things in the Welsh valleys.
Yeah.
So the infrastructure plan could actually be a regional plan. It could be a regeneration plan, an HS2, something like that. But in a sense, go and do it.
Do it.
And do it in places that would have a really positive effect.
Yeah.
Especially in places that are hurting. But maybe there aren't votes in it.
Yeah.
Maybe they're going to vote for you anyway. I mean, that's, who knows? But the politics may intrude on the economics. But the economics is solid here. Go and invest in our people. It's a great line.
I agree with that. Yeah, no, I agree with that.
Think of ways it might help mobility. You say, okay, we're going to hire people who are in Yorkshire who are struggling. We're going to let them come down and build the roads in Swindon, whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
But you can help deal with that issue.
Yeah.
But we've got money to spend and people to help.
So your third idea, which slightly different from the others, we'll come on to the others. But your third one is you talk a little bit about the need to create more positive attitudes, and you kind of talk a little bit about public education, use migration and the kind of softening of attitudes towards migration and immigrants since the referendum. I mean, just because you also talk a lot about in the book, I think, which is again interesting area I'm particularly interested in. You know, you quote Bob Putnam's work,
right?
You know, kind of social capital, bonds, and which is incredibly important if we want to be successful. You know, the social bonds that we have, the trust, the reciprocity, all of those things make economic systems work or fail. So public education, positive attitudes.
Yeah, I think what you might characterize a lot of what we've seen would be, you know, facts and emotion, people worried about their identity. And what's pretty interesting in many of these countries is the opposition to immigration is often in places where immigrants aren't.
Yes.
People are threatened. It seems that there's a literature which suggests that actually you can make people have more of a positive attitude when you actually give them information. So an example in the United States, you ask people, what's the crime rate of the indigenous population compared to legal or illegal immigrants? And in many of these places, they say it's much higher for immigrants. Well, the answer is it's not.
No.
The answer is the opposite is true. So apparently some of this research shows that, you know, that actually are significant benefits to going out and trying to talk to people and explain to them, here are the facts. I mean, there's an issue, particularly in America, where we hear about fake news. So no, it's not, in many places, it's not absolutely clear what those facts are. But it's also, so we can think about, say Poles coming into the UK, Romanians, Bulgarians. For an economist like me, there's a really big issue, actually, about housing and about the housing market. And what the housing market does is it impacts mobility.
Yeah.
We know that rising home ownership rates impact mobility. So there's two issues here. It turns out, in economic senses, having 4 million highly educated, mobile, English-speaking people who are white, and it turns out are Catholic, mostly comes to your country, and essentially they're free to move around the country. So they go to places and it greases the wheels of the labour market. So that in economic terms, that has a really big positive benefit. Mm. But for some people, they see that as a bad thing. Actually, it's threatening that it comes to their communities. It's threatening them. So in a sense, the economics you have to balance with how do people feel. But in economic terms, it's an unequivocal benefit. And the reality is they pay more money into the coffers than they take out. And they stay somewhere for 6 weeks and then they move somewhere else. So you have to balance out. People don't like this. They think they've been invaded by Poles, but the economic benefits are high. So then you say, well, we're going to prevent them coming. Well, there's going to be an economic price to that.
Yeah.
And so sometimes you want to put a price tag on things. But having information, trying to get people to understand what's going on. And obviously we're going to have to do something about these deep divisions in our society. Sometimes divisions between cities and rural. We were just talking, there's some evidence we've been seeing, which is that it may well be true that San Francisco, New York, London, Paris, and I was in Trento, Italy, have more in common with each other than London has in common with Yorkshire or with Blackpool or that New York has with Alabama. So these sort of connections and divisions, I think, are something we have to try and deal with in a friendly, helpful way where we try to say, This might be a pot that's about to boil over. We as a society surely have to be able to do something about it to temper it.
And also, I think it touches on this issue which you raise and others have raised, where where there may well be very localized incidents or instances where we will need to do some alleviation of pressure, let's say on public services, GPs or education. And making sure that we can deal with those issues.
Well,
we had the Migration Impact Fund, I think it was called, which was trying to do some of that. And then,
Well, I think that's absolutely right. And if we look back to, there's this great work by Nobel Prize winner Jim Hegman, who's looked at how you evaluate programs. So think about some treatment, something that you try and work with, but the chances of the program being the same in East London.
Yeah.
It's going to be different from Rochdale.
Yeah.
And so I think, in a sense, what you're going to have to recognise is that one size will not fit all.
Indeed not.
And it's going to have to be, going to have to be very much localised. But Hegman talks about what we should be doing is trying to find programmes and continuously evaluating if they work. And he found various programmes in the US which have what we call negative rates of return.
Yes.
So you set up a programme, somebody goes on the program and they're worse off. It's like the kiss of death.
Yeah.
They're worse off by going on the program than not going on it. So you close it down and say, right, we'll go somewhere else.
Yeah.
But you're constantly trying to think, is this a good way to spend our money? Does this deal with a problem? And it may well be that you're going to have to deal with a problem which relates to 600 people and fix that.
Absolutely.
Rather than say, we have no effect at all on 30 million people, but it's better to go and have a really big impact on 600. That may be where you're going to have to start.
Yeah. So on your fourth area you talk a little bit about is childcare and subsidising childcare, as for both for mums and for dads to bring those into the labour market, and but also to make sure that they can get better jobs. They're not constrained by childcare. Just say a little bit about that.
Well, I have daughters and grandkids, and they struggle. I mean, they struggle desperately. I mean, there's a big, particularly in the US, and they live in the US, but there's a huge issue of the work-life balance.
Yeah.
And in America, people work lots of hours and they don't basically have enough, essentially don't have enough time with their family. I mean, when offered the choice, they say, I feel bad about it. But what's happened, particularly with childcare, as I say, is that there's two things, childcare and tuition and basically student debt. And in America, Britain too, these students are paying incredibly high rates of interest on these loans. So you could think about making those deductible, but also making childcare deductible, trying to make it something that has a benefit. You could do it to mother or father.
Yeah, yeah.
And the evidence, I've been working on happiness with relation to kids, and it turns out that if you simply look at the data, it's sort of a puzzle in the data, that it turns out that children appear to reduce happiness. It makes no sense. But it turns out if you start to look at people's financial, once you control for the fact that having children is expensive and it's a struggle, once you control for the financial difficulties, it's that causes unhappiness. So I think if you could help young mums, I mean the pressure. I mean my eldest has got three under three, a pair of twins who are 1 and a 2-year-old, and my other's got a 2-year-old and a 1-year-old, and basically they just need help. I mean they need help. I mean it's And granddad goes and helps. But basically, so these childcare things are, you know, this is a really productive way to help people. And in America, America doesn't have that, but it just doesn't have much parental leave at all. And I just think we have to worry about well-being. And the story I have to tell is that we've seen a rise around the world in depression, anxiety. We've seen it amongst young mums. We've seen a rise in all kinds of feelings. And particularly we're seeing around the world rise in what's called deaths of despair. So we just have to do something about hopelessness, helplessness, isolation, all of these kinds of issues. And a good start will be, you know, let's try and help young parents who are struggling with their kids. I mean, my daughter tells me she buys a gallon of milk every day, just a gallon of milk, and she spends about £100 a week on diapers, on nappies.
Yeah.
Well, that's a lot of money.
Yeah.
You've got three kids.
Yeah.
You've got three kids, you put them in childcare, you can't afford to go to work. Yeah. So let's start to sort that out.
Yeah.
And a rich society ought to be able to help people with little babies. I mean, the other thing is, the other big deal, and we've seen it in the UK, and the rapporteur, Philip Alston, this week, talks about the fact that in the UK by 2020, we're probably going to see 40% of children in poverty. Well, we're going to have to do something about that.
Yeah.
For goodness, poverty overall, but children in poverty in a rich country like the UK, forget about tax cuts for the rich and dropping VAT, whatever. Let's do something about children being in poverty.
Yeah.
Let's go start to fix that. And I think that would make people feel better. I'm sorry.
No, no, I was going to say, I think it was, certainly last week or relatively recently, the report by the Institute for Fiscal Studies looking at SureStart shows the positive outcomes and impact that schemes like that can have. But it reminds us that, in a sense, A, they take a long time, and therefore you need to be at them for a long time.
Well, absolutely.
Dramatic change.
But let's go back to young kids. The story we know about young kids as well. If you can get young kids into school early, it's better to have an extra year of schooling when the child's three than when they're 17. Mm. Think about learning of language. You can put kids into a situation when they're three and four, and they can learn a second language really easily. Well, it turns out, supposing that we think of, let's say, help for the young, help to get them into childcare where we actually teach them a language.
Yeah.
That has a huge effect. You can teach a three-year-old a language between three and five, that if you and I went in there, we went full-time for 2 years, we'd be deep struggle, right? So it turns out that, you know, there are cognitive things that makes sense.
Yeah.
And parents would say, wow, it's great. I've got something creative and positive for my children. Maybe I go to work, maybe I don't, but maybe I get a rest from it. And I'm actually, it's not just childcare, the child being sat in a chair and stuck in a corner. It's, we're going to put them into places where they're going to learn, Spanish, they're going to learn French, they're going to learn something.
Yeah.
And they probably can by the age of five.
Yeah.
No, think of the people, Welsh speakers.
Yeah.
In Wales, the kids can speak Welsh and English by five.
They can.
Let's do it.
And increasingly more and more of them are doing that.
Right.
Which is interesting. Fifth, helping people to move around.
So this is really important. I think this is a really big deal. In the US, here's a statistic that most people probably have no idea is true. In the last 50 years, the proportion of people in America who move has halved. Halved. So I mean by moving, I mean move within a county, in the US, between counties and within a state, or between states. In all of those things, moving has halved. So one of the great fixes, we go back to the presence of migrants, one of the great fixes is to help people move. So go to Greece. Greece has horrible troubles in all sorts, but very non-functioning housing market, non-functioning product market. What was the fix in Greece? It wasn't for Greek unemployed kids to move from Athens to some other place in Greece. They actually left and came to London.
Mm-hmm.
They moved out. Italians, you come here. I mean, I was just at Costa down the road there. And they're all the baristas. But that's about mobility.
Yeah.
And so mobility is a really good thing. Now, go back to Wakefield. The smart young left Wakefield, went to a university. In the past, they'd return and they don't. But the fix is to help people to move. You give them an opportunity. Remember the story which in Britain for so long was that all the jobs were in London, but there were no houses, and all the houses were in the north and there were no jobs. Well, somehow or other, a sensible thing to do would be to give people a help in helping them to move. If you want to move, we need to be able to get you to be able to move to where the jobs are.
Yeah.
If you're in the Welsh valleys, one possibility is we move things in, but sometimes it's hard because the valleys are narrow and it's not really easy to do. But if we give people big incentives to move, we say, you know, we'll pay for you to move, we'll give you a moving subsidy for a couple of years, we'll give you a subsidy, we'll help you to move to where the jobs are, and we'll think of ways of doing that. So a subsidy to moving and to mobility. And it turns out that countries that had the least mobility were the ones hit hardest. I think Spain and Greece.
And you're worried in that as well, which is earlier on in the book, about, you touched on it earlier on, which is about, you know, our housing market, both in terms of prices,
right.
Prices in, you know, in some places more than others, and that presents some challenges. If you're trying to move into a prosperous area and you don't have lots of capital, you can't get in.
Right.
But also home ownership in itself gums up the system in the sense that it doesn't really allow...
Yeah, the work that we've done... Yes, I'm sorry. The work that we've done, actually, despite the fact that you like the idea, I remember Margaret Thatcher said, we want to have a home-owning democracy, encourage, if you encourage home-owning, then they'll vote Tory. Well, maybe that's true. But obviously, we've now seen things around the world, which is that the housing market continued to rise, and the phrase, you know, safe as houses wasn't exactly true, because house prices collapsed for many. And it turns out that in places where the... So think of this, the home ownership rate rises, people in the area all own their homes, but what happens is they greenbelt it, or they use NIMBY rules, so no firms come in. So the fact that there's lots of homes around there means the firms aren't there. So that's a positive to you, but let's go to the giant negative. I mean, I just rode in on the trains into Waterloo, and there's all... I mean, people are just jam-packed. The consequence of rising home ownership rates with these NIMBY rules is that commuting rises hugely and congestion. So obviously this is about, I mean, in many senses in the UK, we don't have enough houses. It doesn't have to be. It doesn't have to be a house you own, actually. I mean, imagine you own a house and it's great and you now have negative equity in it. Well, that's not so great.
No.
People put in $100,000 down payment and the down payment has now been wiped out. But the worry going forward, of course, is that interest rates are now really low.
Yeah.
I actually left the UK in 1989 when interest rates hit 14%. And I was a young lecturer at the University of Surrey. And one month, my mortgage payment, which went directly out of my bank account, so the money went out of the university, so into my bank account, and the mortgage payment was like five pence more. So at the end of the month, I paid my mortgage and I had negative. And I thought, this can't go. So obviously the problem here is that you can't raise rates because everybody's going to get wiped out. Imagine today if interest rates went to 14% or 5%.
Yeah, yeah.
So obviously this home ownership thing is a big deal. And the worries as well about council housing and social housing is that those people are immobile too. I mean, the problem with social housing,
absolutely. You've got
to, I mean, the way we would, if we have social housing, we worry about that. You want to have social housing that allows people at least to move. And that always, you know, you had a council house in some town, Lewis.
Yeah.
Yeah, you were there. There wasn't, I mean, the rent was a third what it would be anywhere else, and you were never going to move.
No.
And that's a problem. So we've got to be able to deal with decent houses for people, but actually people to go to where the jobs are. So we have to kind of deal with that. But of course, when you listen to the debate that's going on, I mean, I'm listening to the debate from the last few days about who's going to be the leader of the Tory party. I've heard none of that. I've heard a little bit about let's deal with the living wage and so on, but mobility, dealing with social problems, dealing with poverty, talking about tax cuts for the rich doesn't exactly help that.
No, in fact, I think in many respects makes it worse rather than easier to deal with.
I agree with that.
Where that money ultimately goes into. Your sixth point is around income wealth inequality, and you talk a little bit about, I suppose, raising tax thresholds at the bottom end, in a sense you can earn more before you start to pay some tax, but you also, I think, you're a fan of tax credits, you know, earned income, you know, while you're in work and such, which obviously we had historically, and they're under pressure in the UK particularly. Just say a little bit about, you know, about that.
I think that it's really back to where we first started from, which was that people want a job. So I've done lots of work on happiness. And if I chose one thing it shows you is that basically having a job makes people happy and not having a job makes people unhappy. So I think the big deal is to make work pay. you've got to give people incentives. And it's something, it's giving things to people that they want. So you give people incentives. So go back to my daughters. Okay, you can go out and earn X, but if you're having to pay X as well for childcare, that doesn't make much sense. And no. The idea of subsidising childcare is that it gives you an incentive to go to work.
Yeah.
Work's good, it has all kinds of positive habits attached to it, and it raises output in the economy.
Yeah.
So this is about changing all this stuff from we'll give billionaires and millionaires tax cuts. The poor at the low end, they want to work. They want to work, but they have to be able to, it has to be work that actually pays something.
Yeah.
My daughter is not gonna go to work, you know, for nothing. I mean, that makes no sense.
No.
So we try and give people incentives to work, perhaps through subsidies, through earned income thing. I mean, the way perhaps to do it is not to just give people welfare benefits, give them incentives to work. So you give them a tax credit. If people are trying to, you basically give a credit to people at the low end to work.
Yeah.
And I think, and in a sense, you just change the mix of things. You move incentives to those at the low end, and probably you're going to see them pretty much pay for themselves, because all of a sudden people find that there's work that they can do.
Yeah.
And if you offer someone £3 an hour, they're probably not that pleased to do it. But if I start to make it £6, £8, £10, £12, as I start to, what the economists would call the offer wage, as I start to raise the equivalent wage that they can get, it means opportunities open. Poverty starts to rise through people's own best efforts.
Yeah.
And I take the view that actually, the low end of the distribution, people want to desperately work. They want to have work with enough hours. And many times you'll see people on a minimum wage, they can't get enough hours.
Yeah, no, quite.
So they're on the minimum wage,
yeah,
and they'd love to work 60 hours a week, and they can only get 20. How does that mean they're idle or lazy? Nothing to do with it. So we simply have to try and rebalance things and try and help those at the low end, because inequality, particularly of inequality of wealth, has risen so much, especially in the United States.
Yeah.
But also here, in the UK, people see that.
So just on that, Danny, because there's a, as you know, there's a very live UK conversation at the minute, which is about raising the minimum wage, you know, the statutory minimum mm-hmm. wage higher again. And interestingly, you know, the Chancellor, you know, late on has kind of come to this issue. What's your take on that? And what should we be just keeping an eye on, in a sense, mm-hmm. the trade-off between, you know, wages and employment, which is always the concern,
yeah,
but
no,
never...
Let's go with it. I mean, in some sense, so let's start out, imagine that wages are £5 an hour or something. So obviously, if we were suddenly to say, let's make them 5,000 an hour, that would have an effect. But we're not talking about that. We're talking about relatively small changes at the low end. And the story around the world, which was that you can't raise minimum wages because that will create big employment effects. The answer is that's turned out to be completely wrong, totally wrong. And it comes initially from studies from my old friends David Cutter and Alan Krug, who sadly just died a little while ago.
Indeed.
And they did some fantastic work where they did work in America on fast food houses between New Jersey and Pennsylvania. And New Jersey raised the minimum wage. You have a nice experiment, and you go and look. Well, what it turns out is that the places in New Jersey that raised the minimum wage, employment rose. Didn't fall, it rose. Why? Well, it turned out here was the crucial link. The first problem in these fast food houses is people only stayed for about 6 weeks. So as you raise the wage, people turned out to stay longer. And the first day, or first 2 days, they weren't working, you had to train them. Well, if someone stays for 3 months, the cost of that two-day training is spread over a longer period. But it turns out that as you raise the wage, people stayed longer. They stayed longer, and as they stayed longer, they were more productive. And the evidence around the world is pretty darn consistent with that. Lots of work done in the UK. I wouldn't say that universally people found positive employment effects, but I think the literature is consistent that there have not been negative employment effects. And we've seen this experiments in places in the US, Seattle, New York, and other places. Basically, there's a $7 federal minimum. Well, they've raised it to 15, and we haven't seen big effects there, partly because costs in Seattle are high.
Yeah.
But I think the answer is that this raise from relatively low levels has actually not had employment effects. it's had productivity effects, and we should experiment more with it, because it turns out it's consistent with my thing, which is give people at the low end a subsidy,
yes,
and subsidize them for staying in work, perhaps give them a premium for if they stay longer, if they don't quit. Think of ways of trying to A, help people at the low end, and secondly, help to raise their productivity,
yeah,
and give incentives to stay,
yeah,
and to work and so on. So I think the evidence is that those who claim that a minimum wage raise would have negative employment effects turns out to be wrong. Not to say that, I go back to my initial, if you raised it to $5,000 an hour, pounds an hour, it would, but at the levels that they're at and the amounts of money we're talking, where you raise it from, you know, 7, 8, 9, 10.
Yeah, and your reading, given what you've been saying, your reading of, let's say, the UK labour market is that there is some, you know, there is still a gap that we can fill in,
yep,
which is, you know, minimum, yep, you know, the wage can go a little bit higher,
yes,
but we don't know how far, but we're not, you know, we don't need to be overly worried at this particular stage.
Partly because there are quality effects. If you raise the wage, you get better people.
Yeah.
That's some of it, right? You raise the wage and people, more qualified people come in and they're more productive.
Yeah.
And so the question is, if you raise it, are there positive things that go along with it?
Yeah.
The evidence that we've seen in the range of stuff, the range of you know, the increases that we've seen suggest that pretty darn much they pay for themselves. So for an employer, if workers stay longer, that's a productivity positive.
Yeah.
And so the evidence is around the world that employers have not said, let me go back to my economics of walking about, when you interview firms and they say, what's happened? They say, it's okay, it's pretty much paying for itself.
Yeah.
So I think that has really positive effects on inequality, makes people feel better, and there's no obvious negative in the society, because I mean, that's just the evidence, but that's why in economics we kind of evaluate things a lot,
yeah,
and it turns out sometimes people were just wrong, and that's a classic case where the literature is supportive in the UK and the US of keep raising that minimum, see if we can give incentives to work. We can think about the ways to do it. You don't necessarily have to do it by raising the minimum. You could do it my way by giving incentives with the tax structure,
yeah,
but
yeah,
you know, pay, I mean, what was the famous thing, which is that you pay the rich more and that makes them work harder, and you pay the poor less and that makes
them
work harder.
Yeah.
That's not true.
No.
You pay the poor more and it makes them work harder.
Yeah.
Because they want to work more. Or they like more hours and they think, gosh, I'll respond to that. Because it's an incentive and it's worth doing.
Yeah.
And they like it.
Yeah. I want to get your, because I've got you, I want to get your thoughts on, you know, so slightly differently, but, you know, people like, you know, David Autor, Ed Glaser in the US, you know, economists that, you know, labour market economists and urban economists, you know, they've begun to do much more work around, focused on, you know, place-based issues, I suppose, which is typically, you know, from classical economics, mm-hmm, is, you mm-hmm. know, is not something that they spend a lot of time thinking about, particularly on the policy side, you know, that we really do need to spend and think much more about, you know, the distributional consequences of free trade, or more open labour markets, or migration,
or
housing. In a sense, the aggregate is great, but as you know, in a sense, as we know, you know, what's going on and the success we see in places like London, or Brighton, or Bournemouth, or even, you know, a place like Manchester, is not being universally felt in a place like Blackpool.
Yeah, well, let's broaden.
So just give me a, you know, give me your kind of, give me some views on that.
Right, let's broaden this. I mean, I've done lots of work in happiness economics.
Yes.
And in a sense, what we've learned from that is that relative things matter, right? And I was told famously about an experiment that was done by a Nobel Prize winner who said that economics is perfect for monkeys. It's not so perfect for people. I'll give you the example. So you do an experiment and you say, here's a bunch of people and you've got two choices. What would you like? You get 6 and everybody else gets 4. Or you get 5 and everybody else gets 1. So in this case, if you choose 6, then, you know, relatively others are better off. But if you choose 5, you get less, but relatively you're better off. And he said, monkeys always choose 6. Because I just gave you a choice between 6 and 5.
Yeah.
Economics will say you'd always choose 6, right? Monkeys always choose 6, but lots of people choose 5 because they want less because everybody else is worse off. So we know a lot about relative things mattering. And so one of the big things you might think with in America we call them the left behinds, but in a sense, with social media and other things, people get to see what everybody else is doing. There's evidence that if I get a BMW, it makes me happy as long as you don't get one.
Mm-hmm.
But if you get one, then I'm not so happy anymore.
Yeah.
So if relative things matter, what we've seen is that the left behinds see that they've been left behind. And the worry is this. The worry, in a sense, is what we've seen is the following. I'm feeling bad and you're doing fine, you're an elite. So I feel better if you feel worse. That may well be where we are, right? So the left behinds feel better if you feel as bad as they do. And we may have then got ourselves into a very bad situation here, where, you know, in a way we would like to think we're all in this together, which we never were. So anyway, so this, I think, is the concern. And I think perhaps it's that it might in some ways explain, say, the support for Brexit and the support for Trump, even though the people who voted for it aren't any better off. They think, well, maybe those others are worse off, and that makes me feel at least they're understanding and feeling my pain.
Yeah.
So in some sense, that's back to my arguments about how you get people to educate people and so on. But
yeah.
It's absolutely clear that relative things matter.
Yeah.
And people have seen, I mean, so the tax cut in America, very interesting, $2 trillion tax cut, which is hugely unpopular.
Yeah.
I mean, a tax cut of $2 trillion, which has raised the debt by $2 trillion, and on any evidence, it's got about 24% support. Partly because it didn't come to me.
No.
I didn't get it. I mean, I'm saying me, relative.
Yeah, yeah.
The lowest half of the income distribution basically didn't get anything.
Get anything at all.
So how is that helpful? And then obviously there's issues about people at the very top. What the heck's going on? Where are we going with this? And the distribution of wealth is so high. I mean, in some sense, there's some great stories about, I mean, we look back in history, what happened when you did that? Marie Antoinette said, let them eat cake. That didn't go down so well. And so I think these are huge social issues that people are aware of what other people have got. And at some point they're going to say, enough. Which is sort of where they are.
Yes.
I mean, in a sense, what we've actually seen is Brexit and Trump are people saying, enough. What about me? And nothing much has changed. And yep. In a sense, that's why the support of Brexit and Trump hasn't really moved much. Even though nothing much has been delivered, they still think, well, at least these folks are trying, and the other ones are standing against us. And so we have this divisiveness. And I think that's the research absolutely says relative things matter.
Yeah. And closing thoughts on, you know, go back to where we, I suppose, where we started, really, Danny, about, you know, are you hopeful that we can make more of these conversations mainstream within, you know, the policy fields that you and I often are in? And in a sense, you know, are you hopeful about the economics profession, albeit, you know, it's only a very small part of the overall debate, but it's an important part, and we know that.
Well, I mean, in a way, that's why I wrote this book. Yeah. The book is very much about trying to be positive and trying to sort of say to people, this is what's going on, and you need to take account of these things, including the economics of walking about, and take a sense of what people are saying. But I don't think I'm that optimistic. And the reason is that we're in the 10th year of a recovery. In a recovery, people are supposed to feel better. And it looks very clear to me that we're about to slow. I mean, there's all the evidence we have around the world is that the Fed rate rises were in error. The trade war has now pushed Germany and Italy and Austria and China into slowing, if not recession. The data in the UK is investment, Brexit, and the combination of Brexit and trade wars and so on have pushed economies into recession through macro errors. So this may be as good as it gets. I mean, we're going to have a rethink, but I'm not optimistic. I'm not optimistic after a dozen years of watching economists who basically haven't changed their ways. I am optimistic in the sense that the financial system is perhaps more stable than it was, and we're not going to see a giant financial collapse like we did in 08 with giant banks failing. But I'm not confident that politicians have learned anything. I mean, look back to where we were in 2007, perhaps. You probably would have said in 2007 the UK had a functioning government. The US had a functioning government. Unclear today that I could say that about the UK. I mean, supposing this recession comes, the central bank is a big issue because now we have a governor. There's a functioning central bank, but there might not be by the end of the year. I mean, think so the politicians, some Tory MP becomes prime minister. Well, then we're probably going to have a new chancellor. They're going to have to appoint a new governor of the Bank of England. Who's going to take that? And the fact that no one's going to take it is going to have an impact on the markets coming at the same time, perhaps, when the economy is slowing. And we have no firepower. The Bank of England can't cut rates more than a bit. and may have to go negative. It may have to do very strong action, and we don't have a credible leader. I'm not impugning anything about Mark Carney. Mark Carney is clearly a credible leader, but he's gone. He's gone just as the economy is slowing, just as there's financial nonsense, unclear that we have a functioning chancellor, because he probably thinks he's going to be out of a job in 6 weeks. Mm. So that's a really big deal. So I am concerned, and that's why we have to have these debates, but we should have more of them, and we should engage in issues. How do you encourage people at the bottom end? And how do you get around idiotic ideology? When we talked about minimum wage ideology, you have this, we know what's going to happen, but actually in the world it doesn't.
It doesn't happen.
So it's about debating and thinking about the world as it is, rather than some made-up world that you've dreamt.
My guest today has been David Blanchflower. David, thank you very much for being part of City Talks.
Thank you for listening to this episode of City Talks, brought to you by Centre for Cities. You can find us on iTunes and Stitcher by searching Centre for Cities. Please rate, review and subscribe if you liked what you heard. You can also follow the Centre on Twitter at Centre for Cities, or like us on Facebook and LinkedIn for the latest updates on what the Centre is up to. If you have any comments on the episode or suggestions for topics we should cover in the future, we'd love to hear from you. Do tweet us or send an email to info@centreforcities.org. The music was from Palace Fires by Johnny Foreigner, used with permission, and all rights are reserved.